This week on The Score, the U.S. national debt reaches $22 trillion. What can we expect from the next U.S.-North Korea summit meeting? Can we learn from the peacekeeping mission in Somalia? All this and more on The Score. Don't go away.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Welcome back to The Score from Bering Drift. I'm your host, Rick Sincere. Much of our show will focus on foreign policy this week, with experts talking about Somalia in East Africa and North Korea in East Asia. But first, the national debt of the United States has reached a record high of $22 trillion this week. The U.S. government has been continuously in debt since 1835, so it's something of a natural condition for our treasury and our economy. In fact, the national debt is so commonplace that presidents have seldom addressed the issue in formal policy addresses. Only twice in the past 50 years has a president talked about the debt in a State of the Union message in more than a passing fashion. In this audio montage, we'll hear Presidents Franklin Roosevelt, John F. Kennedy, Gerald Ford, Ronald Reagan, and Bill Clinton talk about the national debt. Listen closely to the numbers Ford reports with such concern. Listen to Clinton's optimism on the occasion of his farewell address in January 2001. The first clip comes from one of FDR's fireside chats in April 1938.
It is worthwhile to remember that the annual national people's income was $30 billion more last year in 1937 than it was in 1932. It is true that the national debt increased $16 billion. But remember that in that increase must be included several billion dollars worth of assets, which eventually will reduce the debt, and that many billion dollars are permanent public improvements, schools, roads, bridges, tunnels, public buildings, parks, and a host of other things meet your eye in every one of the 3,100 counties in the United States.
There are myths also about our public debt. It is widely supposed that this debt is growing at a dangerously rapid rate. In fact, both the debt per person and the debt as a proportion of our gross national product have declined sharply since the end of the Second World War. In absolute terms, the national debt since the end of World War II has increased only 8%, while private debt was increasing 305%, and the debt of state and local government, on whom people frequently suggest we should place additional burdens, the debt of state and local government have increased 378%. Moreover, debts, public and private, are neither good nor bad in and of themselves. Borrowing can lead to overextension and collapse, but it can also lead to expansion and strength. There is no single, simple slogan in this field that we can trust.
No nation in history has ever survived a tax burden that reached a third of its national income. Today, 37 cents out of every dollar earned in this country is the tax collector's share. And yet our government continues to spend $17 million a day more than the government takes in. We haven't balanced our budget 28 out of the last 34 years. We've raised our debt limit three times in the last 12 months. And now our national debt is 1.5 times bigger than all the combined debts of all the nations of the world. We have $15 billion in gold in our treasury. We don't own an ounce. Foreign dollar claims are $27.3 billion. And we've just had announced that the dollar of 1939 will now purchase 45 cents in its total value.
Mr. Speaker, Mr. Vice President, members of the 94th Congress, and distinguished guests. This year's federal deficit will be about $30 billion. Next year's probably $45 billion. The national debt will rise to over $500 billion.
Mr. President, distinguished members of the Congress, honored guests, and fellow citizens, this solemn occasion marks the 196th time that a President of the United States has reported on the State of the Union since George Washington first did so in 1790. That's a lot of reports, but there's no shortage of new things to say about the State of the Union. The very key to our success has been our ability, foremost among nations, to preserve our lasting values by making change work for us rather than against us. The federal budget is both a symptom and a cause of our economic problems. Unless we reduce the dangerous growth rate in government spending, we could face the progress or prospect of sluggish economic growth into the indefinite future. Failure to cope with this problem now could mean as much as $1 trillion more in national debt in the next 4 years alone. That would average $4,300 in additional debt for every man, woman, child, and baby in our nation.
My fellow citizens, tonight is my last opportunity to speak to you from the Oval Office as your president. I am profoundly grateful to you for twice giving me the honor to serve, to work for you and with you, to prepare our nation for the 21st century. America must maintain our record of fiscal responsibility. Through our last four budgets, we've turned record deficits to record surpluses, and we've been able to pay down $600 billion of our national debt, on track to be debt-free by the end of the decade for the first time since 1835. Staying on that course will bring lower interest rates, greater prosperity, and the opportunity to meet our big challenges. If we choose wisely, we can pay down the debt, deal with the retirement of the baby boomers, invest more in our future, and provide tax relief.
Later in the show, we'll touch on the national debt in a conversation with Libertarian Party leader Jim Lark.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
John Dale Grover is assistant managing editor at The National Interest, a conservative journal of foreign policy. He has written extensively about U.S.-North Korean relations, so I asked him about the upcoming summit meeting in Hanoi between President Donald Trump and Chairman Kim Jong-un.
It's been less than a year since the first U.S.-North Korea summit between President Trump and Chairman Kim. How would that summit be assessed? Was it a success?
It was a success in the terms of building peace. And when I say that, I mean that toning down all of the conflict that we had, all the threats of fire and fury, all of the talk of escalation, maybe giving North Korea a bloody nose. In that sense, absolutely a success. It's much better to have diplomacy than to be threatening an attack. In terms of actually moving the needle on denuclearization, not so much.
We're talking with John Dale Grover, who's assistant managing editor at the National Interest, a longstanding magazine of foreign policy. That summit last year in Singapore was sort of set up on the fly. It didn't come with the usual preparations that summits in the past have had. Do you think that the upcoming summit in Hanoi will have better preparation?
I do, and part of that is because you see a lot more on-the-ground talks, lower-level talks between the bureaucrats and the officials who would actually be doing the negotiation, also filling out all the details, doing the inspections. You had Steve Agoon, who talked to his North Korean counterpart, and you see a lot of shuttle diplomacy with the South Korean president, also having summits and talking to his counterparts in the United States. And so there's a lot more groundwork that's been laid here. The question is whether they can pull something off.
Why do you suppose President Trump feels that he has an affinity with Kim Jong-un?
I think part of that is President Trump likes to size people up for their personality and see in different ways in which they might click. And that he thinks by establishing that personal relationship, he can further things in a way that goes over the heads of bureaucrats. And while we can say that certainly was a way to break down the tension that we had building at the end of 2017, beginning of 2018, that doesn't fill in the details, as we've said. So that's good for breaking the ice, but we need to see more details.
What is the strategy that the United States has towards North Korea now? What is the end goal?
So far, the stated end goal has remained the same, which is the complete verifiable denuclearization of North Korea. There's other terms that have been thrown around, FFID, similar kinds of terms, but at the end of the day, the idea is we want Kim Jong-un to give up all of his nuclear weapons. Personally, I don't think that that's possible, but we'll see what we can get. Maybe it's a partial ICBM rollback, maybe it's just building that peace regime that's part of a long series of steps, similar to the opening of China, perhaps, if that even happens.
President Trump tweeted recently that he can foresee North Korea being an economic powerhouse under Kim Jong-un. Now, we know South Korea is an economic powerhouse, but North Korea has been repressed for the past 70 years. Could North Korea develop economically in such a fashion, even under the leadership of Kim Jong-un?
It could. The question is whether Kim Jong-un wants to. So if you look at the 1990s, they had a really bad famine. They lost about two-thirds of their GDP. They had 2 to 3 million people starved to death. They had an attempted coup that was actually put down. And so Kim Jong-un wants to avoid that. So he has engaged in actual free market reforms. Granted, these are very minor reforms compared to what you would call a free market, but they allow competing products now. They have over 400 officially sanctioned markets so people can buy and sell. Farmers can keep more of their crops. They're figuring out incentives work, you know, prices matter, you know, these kind of basic things. But he doesn't want to go too far, right? He wants the stability, he wants the prosperity, but he doesn't want a challenge to his rule. And that's a question, right? If you go too far, you end up like the Soviet Union.
The way you describe his reforms, it reminds me of how China started out 40 years ago in 1979, 1980. It was basically farmers' markets. Is that a model that Kim is using?
It is to a certain extent. This is also why there's been some speculation that maybe part of the reason why the next summit will be held in Vietnam is that Vietnam is another one of those countries that has successfully transitioned to state capitalism or state corporatism, whatever you would want to call it, but something that's certainly more free market. But again, these reforms, I've written about this, we've come a long way. North Korea has certainly come quite a long way, but it's such a long way to go to get to anything vaguely resembling Deng Xiaoping's reforms. And we'll see if Kim's willing to risk it.
And the role of South Korea here is very important, too. President Moon ran on a platform more or less of rapprochement with the North. And has he been working at a faster pace than the United States has, or are they working in tandem? What's the relationship there?
It's wavered. It's certainly not nearly as in tandem as it could or should be. And part of this is because North Korea is very good at trying to exploit any gaps in the relationship, right? So traditionally what would happen is North Korea would say, let's negotiate with America to put South Korea off balance. But recently it's been the other way around. Moon was the one who started to do all the outreach with the Olympics and everything, and that just snowballed, and they've had a lot of summits. So South Korea is definitely speeding ahead with this. They take a different approach. We want denuclearization first, peace later. They want peace now. They want a totally new relationship, and that'll be the basis to eventually get Kim Jong-un to denuclearize. So they have it the other way around, and we're trying to figure out if we can connect that.
The United States and South Korea recently came to an agreement, maybe it's a tentative agreement, on the Koreans paying the United States for the presence of U.S. troops as peacekeepers in the peninsula. How do you think that's going to play out?
Well, frankly, pretty negative. I mean, if you look at the reports in the South Korean press, it was very bad timing for us to bring that up, especially when we're trying to coordinate with North Korea. We're still both concerned about China. Very, very bad timing. I wish that we hadn't gone about that in the way that we did. It's good that we got that settled. That's a political necessity. No one wants that to blow up while we're trying to have this second summit. But that's something that's going to come up again, especially if there is a peace declaration or an actual peace treaty. Kim Jong-un is certainly going to look at that and say, well, why are American forces still here then? And then we'll see how that goes.
The summit in Hanoi is at the end of this month, February 28th, I think.
27th to 28th, yes.
What do you think are going to be the headlines on March 1st? What are people going to be talking about after this summit?
It depends how much they can pull off. At the very least, they'll criticize it by saying that it's just more symbolism. But frankly, again, that's still better than exchanging threats. We can always deter them. We're the most powerful country on the planet. I think it's much better to engage in diplomacy coupled with deterrence than to threaten a bloody nose or anything that might lead to an attack. Let's not forget North Korea has nuclear weapons. We should never, ever forget that. They're his security. He doesn't want to wind up like Gaddafi. He doesn't want to wind up like Saddam. If things work out the way our special envoy has said, he stated in a speech at Stanford that possibly we could have some give on them getting rid of their enrichment facilities, and in exchange we would offer some sanctions relief. We'll see. We'll see how that goes, possibly a peace declaration. Again, it depends what they work out.
Final question. What's the role of China in all this?
China wants stability. Above everything else, China fears a situation in which either a war breaks out or North Korea collapses because of maximum pressure. That would be a nightmare for them because they know that there will be millions upon millions of refugees that will come streaming across the Manchurian border. They don't want to deal with loose nukes. Reconstruction of North Korea would be a nightmare. They have so many people that are in basically concentration camps. Conditions are still very harsh there. So China's whole thing is stability, stability, stability.
Well, that's a good way to end this conversation. John Dale Grover, I appreciate your time today to join us on The Score from Bering Drift. I expect that we'll be talking about this topic again in the future.
There will be more about North Korea in the second half of The Score.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com.
There was a lot in the news this week, so I sat down for a brief conversation with Jim Lark, former national chairman of the Libertarian Party. We talked about the president's plan to declare an emergency at the southern border, the $22 trillion national debt, and the Green New Deal proposed by progressive Democrats.
Let's just talk about this week's headlines. We heard today that the president plans on declaring a state of emergency on the southern border so he can build his famous wall. What do you think of that?
Well, I'm against it. I think that's a really, really bad idea for a variety of reasons. One, I don't think we have an emergency. And two, even if we did, it would be something that when we should be very, very careful about giving the president or allowing the president to exercise such power. One would hope that the Congress would basically rein him in on this, but unfortunately, I don't have much hope that the Congress will do anything right these days.
And the Congress does have the authority to mitigate or declare a state of emergency invalid, but they've never done that, have they?
As far as I am aware, they haven't. But then again, I don't look to the Congress as actually exercising much leadership in such matters.
And what's interesting is it may not be a coincidence that this announcement came at the same time as the United States reached a debt level of $22 trillion for the first time. That certainly is partly in Congress's hands.
Yes, and of course the extent to which the debt has just exploded over the last 10 years is truly frightening. Although many people seem to be blissfully aware that we have this, I guess many people just simply don't understand the extent to which this is going to be a problem. It is a problem and will continue to be a problem.
Well, what are the ramifications of having a debt of as big as $22 trillion?
Well, the extent to which, first of all, the debt in many ways, it's a problem, but it also represents a symptom of the real disease, which is the extent to which government has command over the resources of the people. Government does not actually create wealth, it confiscates it in some fashion, at least typically. There are situations where people have actually voluntarily given money to the government, but that's relatively infrequent. What happens is government, by virtue of its taxing power, commands resources from the productive sector, and the extent to which occasionally government debt does actually provide some goods and services that we may want, but it's not at all clear that the government had to use its command structure basically to bring about those benefits.
I was listening to an interview on the radio today. It was a joint interview between Chris Edwards of the Cato Institute and Marshall Steinbaum of the Roosevelt Institute. They were talking about raising taxes. Chris Edwards obviously was against it. But Marshall Steinbaum made an interesting comment. He said he was in favor of raising taxes to a confiscatory progressive level. I've never heard anyone use confiscatory taxation in a positive sense before. Can you make any sense of that?
Well, if you're someone who believes that essentially the people own all resources, then confiscation of wealth and redistribution is actually a positive good. I'm not surprised that Dr. Steinbaum would feel this way. He has some rather interesting ideas that I find interesting in the sense of sort of disastrous. Unfortunately, I suspect there are a decent number of people, mostly who are not economists, by the way. Very few economists, I think, share his general perspective. But the impetus that basically rich people should not be able to, they really haven't earned what they have, and that we, the people, namely we, the government, have the right to take it and redistribute it. There are many people who subscribe to that notion, and it seems, I don't know if there are more of them now than there used to be, but they certainly are louder than they used to be. They seem to feel much less constrained to share their notions with the rest of us.
And certainly there are members of Congress right now who are sharing those notions. I saw an interesting meme recently that said something along the lines of, before you criticize somebody for being too rich, ask them how rich they made other people.
That's a very good point. By the way, always look on the bright side of life. The extent to which you have people, whether they be academics, whether they be practitioners, whether they be members of Congress or various legislators or members of the executive branch of some state or locality, to have them actually, you'll excuse the phrase, come out of the closet and explain what they're interested in, that their true enthusiasm is for basically taking from some and then redistributing to others, that's actually in many ways a good thing, because now we have a much better idea of who they are.
Yeah, it's good to know what your adversaries are saying so that you can counter them with your own points of view, with your own arguments.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, in many cases, the situation that we're describing here, they're really, it's basically either you agree with me or you don't. Either you believe that individuals have the right to have and hold property, that which you create by virtue of your own labor is yours, sort of the classical liberal or libertarian vision. Those who have a very different vision, there's really not much opportunity for compromise. Unfortunately, it may just be we just have to decide who's got the wherewithal to basically enforce their particular perspective.
This might be a good time to talk about the Green New Deal, which is a proposal by some progressive left-wing Democrats that even Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi has said, hey, hold on a bit. My favorite line in that is that the government should provide a guaranteed income even for people who are unwilling to work.
Yes, and again, once again, always look on the bright side of life, because this statement, which is now, I think people are, those who put this out are trying to walk it back, but I don't know that they can really do that. It's nice to know that seems to be what they really believe, that there is a feeling that by virtue of your being a human being, you deserve to have some wealth, or that you have a claim on someone else's wealth. And it's nice to know who these people are. Unfortunately, I dare say that while their numbers probably are not very large, these people are loud, and many of them are in positions of power, if not at, say, the federal legislative level, at least in certain cities, perhaps in certain state governments. And they present a very real danger.
Well, one of the things about the Green New Deal is that they presented all these magnificent programs that have many benefits, but they never talked about costs. They never gave a price tag. But I think I read some libertarian economists figured it out that if you really did implement this entire program, it would cost about $100 trillion, which is four times the current national debt.
Yes, and this, of course, when you are dreaming big dreams, and many of those who seem to be enthusiasts of the Green New Deal, they are dreaming big dreams, and they have an idea of what they would like to see in terms of society. And for those people, cost really doesn't matter. Those are just mere details. It's the direction that in which they wish to head. unfortunately, most human beings actually have to live in the real world and have to actually deal with someone else's big dreams. By the way, I should note, as maybe in interest to your listeners or your readers, I am a libertarian politically. I am a conservative in terms of my view of the world. I'm actually very suspicious of grand philosophical schemes, and that includes my own, by the way. And I think that most human beings are actually in many ways very conservative. They are not terribly inclined to buy in to the pie-in-the-sky vision. So if those who support a Green New Deal actually try to take it on the road and convince the typical American, particularly somebody who actually works for a living, I think they're going to find it very tough sledding.
Well, that's a good point to end on. At least we're averting a government shutdown, which has its own ramifications. But Jim Lark, thank you for joining us again on The Score.
Rick, it's my pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
When The Score returns, we'll hear from an expert on peacekeeping operations in Somalia, plus another conversation on the upcoming Trump-Kim summit. The Score will be right back. Don't go too far.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit BeringDrift.com. You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Welcome back to The Score. I'm Rick Sincere. Paul D. Williams teaches in the Elliott School of Foreign Policy at George Washington University. He is the author of the recent book, Fighting for Peace in Somalia. I spoke to him on Wednesday at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington, where he had just given a presentation about the findings in his book. Here is Dr. Paul Williams. My first question is, how long has there been war going on in Somalia?
So the war started, I would say, back in the late 1980s is when there was a big civil war that happened in Somalia, and that came to a sort of end around early 1991. But like a lot of civil wars around the world, it never truly finished. And we saw UN peace operations and US-led peace operations deploy in the mid-1990s. But they then all left in 1995. And so since 1995, there's been a number of clan-related and political types of conflict going on in Somalia. And then it wasn't until the very end of 2006 that Ethiopian soldiers brought the new transitional federal government into Mogadishu. So if you think of it in those terms, it's now a period of about nearly 30 years or so where Somalia has been in not always a state of civil war, but serious levels of armed conflict.
What is AMISOM? Where did it come from? How did it get its name?
So AMISOM is just the abbreviation for the African Union mission in Somalia. This was created by the African Union at the very end of 2006 and early 2007. And it was mandated at the time to try and facilitate a sort of peace process and potential dialogue between what was called the transitional federal government, which had arrived from Kenya and brought into Mogadishu with the help of Ethiopian forces. And at the time, the sort of the splinter factions of what was known as the Islamic Courts Union, which after the TFG was put into Mogadishu, splintered into different factions. And so AMISOM was to try and bring some sort of level of stability and hopefully facilitate a peace settlement. Now, in retrospect, of course, that never happened. And very quickly thereafter, the transitional federal government came under attack from various forces that we would now collectively know as Al-Shabaab. And so AMISOM's mandate shifted more to protecting the transitional federal government, mainly from the threat of Al-Shabaab.
I'm going to ask about Al-Shabaab in a moment, but who are the components of AMISOM? What countries are involved?
Yep. So on day one, in March of 2007, there was just one country. This was Uganda, was the only African country that deployed forces. And then at the very end of 2007, Burundi joined the mission. And then right through till the end of 2011, it was just Uganda and Burundi that made up AMISOM. And then since the end of 2011 and early 2012, you had Djibouti became a troop contributing country, then Kenya became a troop contributing country, and then Sierra Leone, and then finally in January of 2014, Ethiopia joined AMISOM. And now today, it's those same contributing countries with the exception of Sierra Leone, because of the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. In 2015, Sierra Leone withdrew its forces because the Somali government didn't want another contingent coming in from that that country.
And Sierra Leone is quite a distance from Somalia compared to those other countries, and that probably is a factor. But where did Al-Shabaab come from?
So Al-Shabaab has its roots in earlier sort of, I would say, quite radical and extremist jihadi movements in Somalia. Probably the most prominent was Al-Ittihad al-Islamiyya, which had operated in the country in the late 1990s. But Al-Shabaab was started life as just a small group of a few dozen sort of radical extremists who were basically made gripes about two sets of issues. One was sort of foreign interference in Somalia, and they wanted a more sort of nationalist type of government, free from what they saw as interference from Kenya and Ethiopia and other neighbors. And the second argument they made was sort of on religious and theological grounds. They complained about the corrupt sort of gangsterism, warlords that were governing Mogadishu at the time. So now this time period is about 2005, 2006. But they really came to prominence when the Ethiopian forces brought the transitional federal government into Mogadishu at the end of 2006. And then Al-Shabaab used as its sort of rallying and recruitment cry that this was an invasion by effectively Christian-led Ethiopia that was on a sort of, you know, modern-day crusade to keep Somalia weak and divided. And so that's where Al-Shabaab has drawn its main sort of political agenda from.
You've mentioned that AMISOM is somewhat idiosyncratic among peacekeeping missions, and what makes it so unique?
Sure, so there's a couple of reasons or factors that make it unique. One is its mandate. So it's very rare in the world of peace operations that we effectively give a mission almost a warfighting mandate, right? Protect a government set of forces from rebels, in this case Al-Shabaab. The second reason it's unique is because there was no ceasefire or political settlement in Somalia before AMISOM deployed. So normally peace operations only deploy after a ceasefire or a political deal. And the third reason why it's so unique and complicated is because of the partnerships that are required to make it tick. So AMISOM, the African Union, provides the soldiers and police, those contributing countries I mentioned earlier. But since 2009, they don't provide their own logistics support. The African Union cannot provide logistics, and it cannot pay the allowances of the troops. So the United Nations provide logistics support. The European Union provides all the money for the allowances for the troops on a monthly basis. And then various partners, particularly the United States and United Kingdom, have provided sort of security assistance in the form of training and equipment for the troop contributing countries. So that's a very complicated set of partnerships on which to work. And then finally, fourth, in AMISOM's area of operations, you've also got what I would call parallel or unilateral forces operating. Ethiopian forces sometimes, Kenyan forces, and US airstrikes and special forces all going on in AMISOM's area of operations, but not under its control. So that's why it's such a complicated mission.
How deeply is the United States involved in the mission or in Somali politics and military operations in general?
Sure. So on the military side, the United States is involved in a couple of ways. One is its training and equipping and its security assistance to the troop contributing countries. And there it's been the most important partner for Uganda, Burundi, Kenya, Ethiopia, Djibouti, and Sierra Leone, as I mentioned before. Then secondly, the American military is also trying to build up the Somali National Army. So there's various, again, security assistance program for the Somali forces, the Somali Ministry of Defense and the like. And then thirdly, there are actually kinetic U.S. military operations going on in Somalia. Since 2007, there's been various airstrikes. It used to be more sort of fighter jet aircraft, but nowadays it's more drones. But there's also been special forces raids done often now in tandem with Somali special forces. But those are the three ways that the American military is involved in Somalia.
And how strong is the commitment of the African Union to continue this mission for as long as it needs to be continued?
Yeah, the African Union Commission and the different TCCs, the troop contributing countries involved, have regularly said they're there until sort of mission accomplished. But obviously for political reasons, no one knows when that will be. This will either hinge on whether there's a political and negotiated settlement with al-Shabaab, because the stalemate we seem to be stuck in at the moment, it seems very unlikely that there's going to be a clear military victory one way or the other in this war. And so AMISOM is sort of stuck in the middle of that political set of issues.
Well, Paul Williams, thank you very much for your time today. It looks like a fascinating book. I hope I get a chance to read it sometime.
Thanks very much, Rick. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Did you miss a previous episode of The Score? Look for our podcast at BearingDrift.com.
During the first half of the show, we heard the perspective of John Dale Grover of The National Interest on relations between the United States and North Korea. That same day, I also talked about that topic with Eric Gomez, a policy analyst in defense and foreign policy studies at the Cato Institute. We focused on the upcoming meeting between President Trump and Chairman Kim, scheduled to take place on February 27th and 28th in Hanoi, Vietnam.
It's been less than a year since President Trump and North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un met in Singapore in the first summit. Was that summit judged to be a success?
I think that the primary problem with the first summit is that it didn't really have much in the way of specifics. And so a lot of people have been, a lot of experts and also people sort of outside of government has been criticizing the results of that summit because it was pretty broad, and North Korea never really agreed to do much in the way of specific measures. And so what we've seen since then is a lot of good researching and reporting on what North Korea has been doing with its nuclear program and with its missile program that seem to suggest that, you know, they're just sort of going about business as usual, more or less. And so I think the problem was that since the summit didn't get specifics on limiting those, of course they're not going to stop doing what they're doing. So I think that in that way, people kind of viewed it as a bit of a disappointment. I'm a bit more optimistic about the first summit. We were never going to get, you know, everything we wanted in the first meeting. But I thought that it was a good way to show the North Koreans that this time, from the United States perspective, we're approaching things differently. And that might create some possibilities for some things in this upcoming summit that might surprise us in a good way. In terms of North Korea being more willing to move the needle on certain issues that they previously might not have been able to or not willing to do.
We're at the Cato Institute right now talking with Eric Gomez, who's a policy analyst in defense and foreign policy studies. Specifically, we're talking about U.S.-North Korea relations and the upcoming summit, which will be held in Hanoi, Vietnam, at the end of this month. Is the setup for the second summit different than the first one, which seemed to be sort of on the fly rather than the sort of traditional summit, which is preceded by a lot of smaller meetings with lower-level officials leading up to a presidential-level meeting? Is this one being planned in a better way?
Oh, yes, definitely. It's a night-and-day difference. So, as you pointed out, in the first summit, very much sort of on the fly, very quickly organized. And Trump didn't really have much staff in place at the ambassador level, at the special representative level, to actually do that sort of early work. But now it's very different. Steve Biegun, who is the U.S. special representative to North Korea, has been very busy traveling to North Korea, to other countries, to talking with the North Koreans, the South Koreans, having working-level discussions to hammer out what exactly are they going to agree to at the summit. And I think that's a very good sign that these levels of working level talks are happening with such frequency. It's good to have that level of communication, that frequency of communication. There are some unanswered questions about what is going to be agreed to at Hanoi. There's been some sort of bits and pieces leaked out in the media, or, you know, you can kind of infer that some things are on the table, but the specifics are really light. But I'm confident that this new summit will have agreements that are much more finely detailed and much more in the weeds than the first one did, which the first one was basically a sweeping statement over, here's what we're going to work for. And also what's different is that the South Koreans are very involved in the process, and they met with Kim before Trump did the first time. But since then, they've had even more working-level meetings. They've established a liaison office at Kaesong, which they have sort of daily more or less daily interactions with the North Koreans. And also, they've implemented a very detailed military confidence-building agreement along the DMZ with the North Koreans that has worked out very well so far in terms of both sides following through on their commitments and actually doing so in a verifiable way. So it's a much, much different sort of international situation and structural situation heading into this new summit.
If I recall correctly, South Korean President Moon was elected on a platform that sort of promised rapprochement with North Korea. Mm-hmm. How does that affect South Korean relations with the United States, where, other than President Trump, most analysts would be rather skeptical of North Korea's intentions?
That's a very good question. I'm not... Okay, so I think that for the South Koreans, the big thing that's different is that Moon still has a lot of time in office, which is important. He is going to serve a 5-year term, and I believe he's only about 2 years into it so far. And so that means that he's going to have a lot more opportunities to keep the talks going with the North, also to keep things moving with Trump. And I think that the South Koreans, following their summits with the North and the U.S. summit with the North, they started moving very quickly to establish rapprochement. And it was very popular within South Korea, but it caused some friction in the alliance with the United States because we were concerned about them moving too far, too fast ahead of us. My own view on that is we shouldn't have been concerned. I think Moon knows what he's doing, and I think that he wouldn't do anything that would risk some kind of split or divide in the relationship. But, you know, for the South Koreans, I think the bigger sort of question for them is Trump himself, because back in 2017, he was sort of the big driving force from a rhetorical standpoint of turning up the pressure and turning up the risk of conflict, and the South Koreans didn't want that at all. And then after they begin this sort of outreach and rapprochement, they get a lot of success, and then, you know, the United States sort of says, pump the brakes. So I think that if there's any kind of friction or difference in the U.S., South Korean position, I think a lot of it is sort of coming from inside the United States or inside the White House, as I'm fond of saying. And the recent special measures agreement, which deals with South Korean payments to the United States for hosting troops in South Korea, that negotiation was very complicated because the U.S. pushed very hard for more and more money from the South Koreans for burden sharing and to cover those basing costs, and the South Koreans weren't prepared to go as high as we wanted. There was an interim agreement for 1 year instead of 5, but that means that we're going to be addressing the issue again next year, and I think that that's a mark of frustration. I think many of the issues in the U.S.-South Korean relationship that we saw in the sort of middle to late 2018 have been smoothed over, and I think that is good news for both the inter-Korean peace process and the U.S.-North Korea and South Korea, you know, the three-way sort of peace process. But I do think there are some lingering issues and concerns that mostly deal with Trump. If Trump were to lose the election in 2020 and a new president were to come in, I think that new president would sort of have a more even-keel relationship with Seoul than Trump has had.
President Trump recently tweeted something along the lines of North Korea could have a very strong, vibrant economy, that Chairman Kim could lead it in that direction. Now, we know culturally from mm-hmm. South Korea that if it weren't for the repressive regime in the North over the past 60, 70 years, that North Korea would be a rich country. But could it actually happen under the leadership of Kim Jong-un?
I think it's possible. And in terms of what – I think this gets to what is driving Kim's domestic agenda, which is very important. I think that based off of the level, you know, he, in terms of this new line of economic development, he has said this in back-to-back New Year's addresses. He said it in April of 2018 at a meeting of the party leadership within North Korea. And then he did a on-the-spot sort of inspection tour of major economic projects that had started either, I think, during his tenure or maybe some slightly before, and was very critical of the people who were leading those projects because they weren't making fast enough progress. And all of that was very highly publicized in North Korean media. And so that's for their like own internal consumption. So I think that his desire to have economic improvement is sincere. I don't think that's a sort of trick or anything like that. And then the other issue is, how does he define himself vis-a-vis his father and grandfather? Kim Jong-un, each of them had their own sort of things or accomplishments that made them unique. And I think that Kim Jong-un has a desire to figure out what is his legacy going to be. And he's pretty young. I'm not sure exactly how old he is, but I think he's still in his early 30s. And he's going to be, you know, most likely around for a while. And one good way to have that kind of long-lasting legacy and to have that kind of something that sort of stands the test of time is through a more economically prosperous society. And I think he viewed nuclear weapons as, especially an ICBM, as the kind of insurance policy, right? To make sure that you wouldn't have the war and that you wouldn't have an armed conflict, he had to sort of rush to try and get that as fast as he could. And now that he has that insurance policy, he can start to negotiate. Now, this raises the question of, does he ever give away the insurance policy? And I think that if denuclearization ever happens, it's going to be 10, 20 years down the line. But I think the problem with the U.S. approach to North Korea is that we have viewed denuclearization as our top priority. And in South Korea, the view is much more, we need to change the whole structure of our relationship with the North, and then we maybe get to denuclearization later. And I think based off of what Biden has said at recent press conferences, it sounds like the U.S. position is starting to sound more like the South Korean position, where we understand that we're going to have to think about this problem in the way of, okay, what can we do to actually convince the North Koreans of their security to the point where they give up the weapons? Because it's kind of clear that just sort of pressuring them nonstop and trying to force them to give up the weapons isn't going to work.
Just in the 30 seconds or so we have left, yeah, what kind of headlines do you expect to see after the summit at the end of this month?
I'm hopeful that there will be a peace declaration, something that is a sort of non-binding political non-legally binding political statement to say, we are going to work towards ending this war. We are going to finally sort of get that legal change done, because that will be a very important indicator of what I said before about the change of the relationship and changing how North Korea sort of views the United States on a day-to-day basis. And it won't have, it's sort of a formality, because obviously there isn't an active state of war sort of on a day-to-day basis. But as long as that's kind of like the legal and political backdrop for all of the interactions, that's going to affect them. And so I think that if there can be a peace declaration, Seoul would love it. North Korea would really like it. The U.S. would like it. It wouldn't require us to really give up anything. And I think it would be a very positive step to changing stuff. And it could open up the doors to North Korea doing stuff and giving up certain things that it was previously unable or unwilling to do.
Well, that's a positive note to end on. Eric Gomez, I appreciate your time today. Thank you for joining us on The Score from Bering Drift, and we'll be following up on this issue.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you. Thank you.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Since we had such a focus on foreign policy this week, I thought I'd search through the archives for an interview on international topics. I found one from the Virginia Festival of the Book in 2014 with Stanford University historian Robert Rekov, author of the book Kennedy, Johnson, and the Non-Aligned World. From the archives, talking about the 1960s, here is Robert Rekov. Could we just start by having you introduce yourself and the book you're here to talk about today?
I'm Rob Rakove. I teach history at Stanford University, albeit in the International Relations program, and I'm here presenting my book, Kennedy Johnson in the Non-Aligned World.
One question that arose in my mind while you were talking about the Kennedy-Johnson era, foreign policy in that time is associated mostly with Vietnam, but in your research, did you find a foreign policy situation that was underreported at the time or underestimated that you as a historian think is more important than people gave it credit for at the time?
Yeah, actually, there are a number that come to mind in that sense. In the first place, I might note the colonial question in Africa, which only engaged a relatively compact subset of the American population. African Americans were, of course, deeply moved by the plight of Africans under Portuguese colonial rule, as they were also by the apartheid regime in South Africa and what would be the white minority regime in Rhodesia, which declared its independence in autumn 65. And that actually turned out to be a big fulcrum of international politics. In the 70s, Portuguese Africa would play its own part in helping to reignite the Cold War and helping to undermine the stability of the détente regime. That's one. Also, in hindsight, the early 1960s has the curious distinction of being a really quiet time in the Arab-Israeli conflict, pre-Oslo, of course. And it was established by, I think, a very interesting policy on Kennedy's part of while ensuring Israel's security, also reaching out to Egypt. And so this was a very difficult balancing act on his part, one that came undone in the Johnson years, and I think one that was underappreciated because as one of its key pillars, U.S. agricultural support for Egypt, crumbled, Egypt lost an incentive to remain on the sidelines to avoid seeming militant in the Arab-Israeli conflict, and they were already being goaded by other states to do more and to demonstrate that they were true Arab nationalists.
You talk about sort of the different ways that Kennedy and Johnson approached foreign policy. Do you think the fact that John F. Kennedy lived abroad in his youth had an effect on his thinking on foreign policy?
Absolutely. As well as some of his travels when he was still fairly young, I think when he was a young congressman, he kept a journal from his travels, which I've had a look at. Unfortunately, his handwriting is awful, so I think I need to come back to that. But he went abroad at an interesting time as anti-colonial nationalism was cresting in much of Africa and Asia. And he could observe its force, and he could also observe the fact that it was not communist, that actually a lot of these folks had no truck with communism. Nasser's favorite thing to do with communists was put them in prison. And that's a depth of international exposure that Johnson lacked. Johnson did travel as a vice president, but I think the types of missions he had, usually to reassure allies, in turn dictated his outlook when he was in office. That it was about that foreign policy was often about reciprocating allied support, about demonstrating this one facet of credibility, not thinking as broadly as Kennedy had.
Final question: could you just tell my audience why they should read your book? What is in there that they might not learn anywhere else?
I want to stress that there are plenty of great books about both presidents and the U.S. involvement in the post-colonial world, and they'll be listed in the bibliography, and I'll credit them. But I think what I bring to the table is a comparison of the two presidents that sheds light on the real differences that accompany each into office, which have a way of becoming prominent as a policy, as an idea moves further and further down the chain of command. But also I hope the book helps people to think about how presidents and the country is viewed overseas and the ways by which we can and cannot shape that.
I appreciate your comments, and I look forward to seeing the book.
The third question is the tough question.
That's all the time we have this week for The Score. For all the writers and editors at Bering Drift, I'm Rick Sincere. Be sure to come back next week for more news, reviews, and interviews. Don't forget to tell your friends where to find us, and let us know what you think by leaving comments on our website at BeringDrift.com. Until next week, so long from The Score.
you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit beringdrift.com.